Today my guest is Dino, I'm going to try to say this right, Esposito.
Nope, wrong.
Esposito is me.
Esposito?
Esposito.
Seriously?
Yeah, no, no. Cito's in the U.S.
Well, let's say it the way that your family says it. Tell me your name.
No, it's the correct pronunciation is Dino Esposito.
Esposito, okay.
Yeah, so you got it
closer
right.
Closer the first time.
Yeah, but in the U.S., Esposito for friends in the U.S.
Okay, all right, I get that. We're famous hockey players. For years. I think they're actually Canadian.
I know. Yeah, actually but, Canadian.
Their ancestors were from, I think, France or England.
Well, they play for Montreal or what kind of
That's a good question. I've forgotten. I think one of them played for Philadelphia. And one might have played for, you know what, I better not answer this because there'd be some hockey fans.
Anyway. I couldn't care less about hockey, so I'm a tennis guy.
Tennis guy, okay. Let's talk about a big ball of mud.
Oh, big ball of mud.
Because I caught your talk earlier today at Dev Connections.
Yes.
What was it called? Software Do's and Don'ts, I think was the title. But it was really about patterns and anti-patterns among software architecture and even beyond that, even higher than that, software project management, really, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean... The fundamental point is that for my personal curiosity, I always try to get at the core of the things and the heart of the things. So I just try to excerpt the mechanics out of things, and software is no exception. So when I started phasing in the past years software projects that couldn't work or couldn't come to an end, couldn't successfully come to an end, well, I always wondered why, and well. Year after year, failure after failure, I sort of managed to try to make sense of the mechanics, inherent laws that make things go wrong or right when it comes to software development and management of software projects.
Right.
So the talk that you mentioned, Do's and Don'ts of Software Projects, is an excerpt from my classes. It's a classic that I present at conferences. And there I just explain why it can go wrong, like in a sort of new edition of the Murphy Laws. If something can go wrong, it will.
Right.
So, and why it goes wrong, that's my perception.
And there's a lot of reasons why. So you open with this ball of mud analogy, which is like the spaghetti code thing.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, the mud that you mentioned is coming from, the big ball of mud is an expression coming from a popular paper. From researchers of some university, I can't remember the details now, but...
It's the University of Esposito, I think.
Excuse me?
The University of Esposito.
Oh, maybe. No, actually, no. It's a serious paper, right?
Okay.
And in which the researchers, but you know, we're talking about a work that being done at least 20 years ago.
Okay.
They just try to formalize why software projects sometimes fail. So I just built on top of that. And the concept of big ball of mud is that, like on a snow avalanche, it starts smaller and smaller and smaller and grows as it comes down the hill, up to it can be destructive, it can gain a destructive force.
Right.
So in software, it's don't be surprised by the analogy, but in software it's the same. A bug or an architectural bug is small in the beginning, but it grows bigger and bigger as the size of the project and the features in a project are added, up to a point that it becomes sort of unmanageable. And the question is, okay, we made a disaster. Now what? So big ball of mud is simply a way to find an analogy with something we can observe in the real world to describe the mechanics of software.
Okay. Yeah, and I think you made a key point there, which is that it doesn't start as this giant ball of mud. It starts as a small problem.
Yes, and also one developer is never the starter. He's never the only culprit, the only responsible for that. It doesn't start overnight, and it's a teamwork.
So what are some of the things that contribute to the software failure? I think I read somewhere that some amazing percentage of software projects fail, well above 50%.
I have no idea in terms of how many of them fail. It's fairly common.
It's fairly common.
It's fairly common.
It's more than it should be. I think that's fair to say.
Or, and I think that if we put things differently from another perspective, and the other perspective could be how many projects or what is the percentage of software projects that actually succeed.
Right.
That is very, very small.
Well, let's talk about success then. What can we as software developers and managers do to increase the chance of success of a software project?
I would start by defining when we can call a project a successful project.
Okay.
So when essentially we can build it fairly close to budget and fairly close to requirements.
Okay.
What can we do to achieve these two kind of things? Obviously, the key point here, the only variable here, is requirements. Because based on requirements, you estimate the costs, you define the budget, and requirements also define the lines of code you write, the modules you build, mm-hmm. the services you create, how you make them interact, and all a long list of additional helper activities like testing, like debugging, like profiling, and so forth. So it's all about requirements. And unfortunately, requirements are not something constant. And even when they are constant in the few fortunate cases in which we can consider them constant, there is no guarantee that they are right.
Okay, so even constant over time.
Define
them in January, they may change by February or July.
Yes, and sometimes even in a shorter amount of time. So the point is really that we should start thinking that we live as software architects and developers in a world in which we experience continuous change.
Right.
So there's something called requirements churn, which measures the frequency at which new requirements are received by development teams. So just the frequency rate, okay? So 3 a day, 4 a month, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And you measure requirements churn. So the highest is the value. The worst is the situation of the project, and the smartest are architects expected to be in order to face that and to keep that under control.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you add a new requirement to an existing system, no matter the stage and the phase of the system, it could be beginning, could be mid, could be close to an end. If you add a new requirement, mathematically, you modify the context.
Okay.
Now, by simply adding one requirement, you probably create a delta that is not significant enough.
Fair enough.
It doesn't have impact, or it has a negligible impact on the entire system. But in presence of a strong requirement churn, so requirements that keep on coming on a regular basis and frequently and high rates, well, the configuration of the system, the context of the system changes frequently.
Mm.
And you must, as an architect, you must be ready to detect symptoms that could reveal a sort of big ball of mud forming. You should be able to create some sort of tests, okay, to detect the fact that the system is being deteriorated, and put some activity in place to fix that. Symptoms, typical symptoms of software that don't work as expected, that we make jokes on usually. So I modify class A, but I introduce a mistake in class B, which was not apparently involved in the change.
I call that the butterfly effect.
Yeah, the butterfly effect.
Butterfly flaps his wings somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, and there's a typhoon in the South Pacific.
Yeah, but if you read the paper on Big Bottle Mud, there's a long story about this, and it's formalized. This phenomenon is given a scientific name.
Wow.
And it's nice,
Yeah, my name is a nickname. But yeah, it's because of hidden dependencies.
Because of hidden dependencies.
Effects, unknown side effects.
Absolutely.
So decoupling is a big
And there is also another
solution to that.
Another feature, another symptom, is called viscosity of software, which is essentially when you detect, you are reported, or you discover a bug or something that has to be fixed, and you know what would be the right way of solving that, addressing that point, but mm-hmm. you are scared of putting your hands right
well,
there.
Because it's fragile. Because the
because it's fragile, yes. You perceive the inherent, you can feel on your own skin the fragility of that piece of architecture, and you're scared.
Right.
So what you do in that case, because you're scared, you try to find a bypass, a workaround, a patch that solves the problem locally without addressing the surrounding architecture and system. So you add patch on top of patches.
Wow.
And you take this one step farther every time, every day, and in presence of a strong requirement churn, this is everyday work. You have been explained why and how the big ball of mud can get formed.
That's interesting. I just recently read Michael Feather's book on legacy code. Are you familiar with this book?
No, but I'm probably familiar with I never read this book, but yeah.
He talks about some methodologies for addressing legacy code, like you described. It has all these decoupling, or there's excessive coupling. And sometimes what you need to add a new feature is to put that feature in a new method or a new class in order to not risk touching the class that's very fragile. And then you could test your new class. And the problem with that is by adding a new class just for the sake of this, it makes the system as a whole more complex. So even though you haven't broken anything and you haven't risked breaking this
you
system,
added complexity.
You added complexity for no other reason than to make testing a little bit easier. And
absolutely.
There's a trade-off there. And if you continue to do that, then over time your system will get more complex.
Yeah, complexity is already found, easy to detect in modern systems, the natural state. But so the artificial complexity we add because of coding practices, that should at least that one should be avoided.
Yeah, so we're avoiding, there's no cohesion there. I've got something in this class that really belongs in that class. These two belong in the same class together, and yet I'm separating them for my own convenience.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So there are several practices, just to cut a long story short, common practices that unfortunately only increase the big ball of mud by introducing bad habits and things that taken individually are not big deal, but all together, they form.
Okay.
A drop per se is nothing, but a drop can make the entire container pour out.
Right, right.
Yeah,
these are temporary fixes that we need to be aware of and change them. So you've been on a lot of projects that somebody else started and that have already turned into a ball of mud.
Right? No, I honestly have to say that my activity in the past 20 years, I would say, has never been particularly focused on consulting, on projects. So I have a limited direct experience.
Okay.
So you say, academic. But you came over here on a stage to talk about, to tell us what to do and what don't to do and what not to do with projects, and you have no experience. Yes, but because exactly, yeah, the point is precisely this one, because I put any effort in just analyzing, like a scientist in a way, just a researcher, the mechanics in a sort of unbiased way, because I had no special feeling, positive or negative, coming from experience. Okay. I just look at things. I try to figure out from documentation, from literature, what was the state of the art, and I just applied logic and formalism, coming to the conclusions that I'm sharing now.
Yeah, what's your opinion on? You talked about if architects discover there's a lot of churn, and that churn tends to get worse over time. Do we stop that churn? Is it better to stop that churn, or is it better just for the architects to just become more flexible and more agile?
Ideally, in a perfect world, we have a very limited or no churn at all. But it's nearly impossible to stop because of the business.
Yeah, and because we don't have all the information at the beginning of a project, typically. Even though we often kid ourselves when we tell
ourselves. That's right. That's not a good point. Yeah, often, very often, too often, I would say. Now, regularly, we start projects with user stories when we have only a faint idea of what we are actually going to build, and we just iterating, so in an agile way, iterating over building of prototypes, we help ourselves and help our customers sometimes to form a better idea. So in this context, the requirement churn can only grow and becomes a constant of the system. So that's why I said earlier, we live in a continuous change kind of world.
Right.
And the requirements chart, which is a negative thing, becomes a part of the deal. We have to face it, period.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And the other reality is, even if we knew everything at the beginning, the world is not constant. The world changes. So it may be that the market has changed, and now we were building this in-store application, and now that's not appropriate anymore. And maybe the entire market is shifting to the web, or it's shifting to mobile devices. And all of a sudden, in the 18 months since we started this project, the market has changed very much, and our assumptions are no longer valid.
We must be ready to face change at significant speed rates, and try to put any effort in the design of the things we do to be able to address and be responsive to this kind of change the best we can.
Mm-hmm. What kind of advice can you give to people that are trying to manage this?
I would say try, put any possible, humanly possible effort in understanding requirements mm-hmm. the best you can.
Okay.
And in the interviews you do with customers, try to challenge them. I mean, don't be afraid to say no to a customer requirements, not because the customer wrote a particular particular text in a particular bullet point in a particular Word document. That feature, that has to be turned into a feature encoded into the final application. That needs to be part of a system, and it's the responsibility of the software architect to take out of a list of bullet points classes, entities, behavior, components, functions, modules.
Right.
It's the overall picture, the big picture is up to you, software architect, mm-hmm. and it's your responsibility to understand, to acknowledge, to assess requirements, and don't be afraid of challenging customers. So in my opinion, you don't need this feature. No, I need it. Why? Prove me wrong, or I will prove you right. It doesn't matter who's the winner, if the customer or the architect in this kind of fight, you know, everybody trying to prove wrong the other. But as long as there's one winner, there is one more fact added to the list of certain facts in the requirements of the app.
Right, you're right. And not every feature requested has the same cost, which is a big factor. And not every feature requested has the same priority. So even if it's a feature that the customer could use, the fact is that if I work on feature A, that means I'm not going to be working on feature B at that same time. Like, I only have so many...
Yeah, the other big problem is that, you know, when it comes to the endless battle between management and development teams.
Why does it have to be a battle?
both parties try to pursue their legitimate objectives, each part with its own style, which is typically an aggressive style on behalf of managers, and it's a kind of passive style on behalf of developers, maybe because of the attitude. I see this, I observe this, but I have no really an explanation for that.
So you think it's a communication style
that
is really the barrier to getting these things?
And the fundamental point is that managers, they at any time need to know how much they're going to pay and what they're going to get out of the money they pay.
Mm-hmm.
And developers are not able, especially at the beginning of the project, to correctly estimate the effort and subsequently the costs, because the manager reasons and sometimes the customers reason in terms of high-level features, but they are not able to outline the nitty-gritty details of what, say, a login page or a registration model really means.
Right.
Okay. So they could say to you, well, we need to have on the website a page for letting users register to our services. Fine, but that could probably mean in the beginning just adding a form with a username, password, some personal details, and that's it. But at some point, say no, yes, but at a later time, it can come up the need that, well, it would be nice to have also social network authentication.
Sure.
Yes, okay, we are still talking about the same registration page,
yep.
But it means a lot more work. It means selecting the right library to do the same kind of thing across multiple platforms if we are involving, for example, mobile apps. Mm-hmm. So it could really be a significant mm-hmm. extra amount of work that cannot be, you know, calculated in the same budget allocated for the plain, basic, trivial, silly, stupid registration page.
Right.
So precision is not always possible, and both parties, management and development, must be aware of that.
I have fallen into that trap before where the management tells me a requirement, and they think they've explained it to me thoroughly, and I think they've explained it thoroughly, and they've left things out. They haven't verbalized them. And I only code to what I hear. I don't tend to code to what I didn't hear. But in their mind, they've communicated these sort of implied things.
And yes.
I've delivered something they didn't want.
I was at a conference in Poland a couple of weeks ago, and there was a nice presentation from a nice guy. And at some point, he said something that I would like to quote now. He said, "If it's not on my calendar, it doesn't exist."
Okay. Yeah, good point. Computers are like that. Computers, they only do what we tell them to do. They're not intuitive.
Yeah.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that we should?
Oh, probably not in the realm of software management, but we can have another maybe interview talking about mobile or other topics.
We could do that. Yeah. You know, you're the only the second Italian I've ever had on my show. I'm up at almost 300 episodes.
Oh, really?
Yes. Okay. Dino, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Bye. I'm not known to be a friend of any technology in particular, but I do love technology and friends.